Phil Radio, a voice you can trust. Broadcasting live presents Two Guys and a Bible with Don Preston and William Bell. Join us each week at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central as we bring you exciting, sound, challenging, and comforting messages regarding the end times. Thank you for tuning in today. Don Preston is the founder of Preterist Research Institute, or PRI. Don is a prolific author, having written and published 19 books, a host of audio and DVD studies, and is a debater and defender of the full preterist view. His websites are BibleProphecy.com, Eschatology.org, and DonKPreston.com. William Bell is the founder of AllThingsFulfilled.com Ministries and has a website bearing the same name, and has authored 3 books, audios, and DVDs. He has published hundreds of articles and recordings. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Guys and a Bible broadcast with Don Preston and William Bell.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is William Bell and Don Preston. Happy New Year to you once again, and we want to thank each of you for tuning in with us today on Two Guys and a Bible. And we've had a little difficulty getting on the air, but we have resolved that problem, at least temporarily, by dialing direct, and I have Don on the other line. So, Don, are you there?
I am. Pardon me. I am here, William.
Okay.
It's always good to be on air and to be with our listeners. We appreciate everybody tuning in.
All right. Well, very good. Well, I believe we have a very exciting broadcast for you tonight, very exciting show tonight. We certainly enjoyed the interview last week with John Carlisto, and I've heard nothing but good reports from those who took the time to listen to that, and I would encourage that you go back and listen as well. And we enjoy all of the broadcasts that we have on Fulfill Radio, and we encourage you to check those out as well. Don, tell me, you know, what's going on over in Oklahoma? We got some rather inclement weather here in Memphis, Tennessee. So how are things going on over in Oklahoma?
Well, it's actually been a pretty day, but it's turned cold on us. They keep saying we're going to have some single-digit weather, but it's so far, thank the good Lord, we haven't had that single-digit weather. It's been cold enough to have a fire in the fireplace, which I absolutely love. And, you know, nothing like sitting by an actual fire with a good book, you know, and just sitting there, kick back, and I'm really, really enjoying that.
Oh, yeah, I know what that's like. You know, in the house I'm in now, we have a fireplace, but it's a, you know, gas log fireplace, and I certainly don't enjoy that. I don't enjoy that at all. But let me tell you, look, when we were in the previous house, and you know which one I'm talking about, we had a fireplace, and it was just a thrill for me to, you know, light the fireplace during the winter. And sometimes Leora and I would actually just fall asleep right there in the living room in front of the fireplace. And what I would do is through the night while she's sleeping and under the cover, I'd just, you know, when we didn't have enough, you know, when the wood would burn down, I'd go right outside and keep the fire burning all night long. And she'd never know the difference the next day. But it was one of the, you know, one of the highlights of just being in that house in the wintertime and being in the fireplace.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Absolutely.
It's really kind of funny. Normally, I'm a person that if I have to get up sometime during the night, anywhere after 2:30 or 3, normally if I have to get up, I don't really go back to sleep at all. I mean, I'd just as well get up and go to work because I'm not going to go back to sleep. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the fireplace, I can get up during the night, come in, stoke the fire, go right back to bed, go right back to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, because that snap, crackle, and pop, man, and that warm heat is just it's just really, really soothing and relaxing.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. Nothing like it.
Well, that's true. All right, so what's on the agenda tonight? I thought, you know, as we discussed earlier, we'd talk a little bit about what fulfilled eschatology means for us today. And I understand that you've been doing some studies on that on your YouTube videos. And so I thought that would be a great topic to discuss here as well, and would like to invite you to take us down that journey.
Well, this is not going to be a one-way conversation.
I'll do my best to pitch in here and there.
You know, you know as well as I do, because you've been at this as long as I have, if not longer. But one of the most common questions that we are asked is, okay, you say the Lord came in AD 70, so what does that mean? What does that mean for us? And, you know, all the years that we went to the Abilene Christian University lectures, and by the way, I've been invited to come back, and may very well try to do that, set up a booth again, but be that as it may, how many times during our presentation to people would they listen very attentively? They would like what they're hearing, and then it's like, well, okay, what does that mean? What does it mean for me today if the Lord came? And, you know, some of them ask, so what? and not so much of an open-minded question, but others very, very attentive, very, very interested, and naturally wanting to know what this means. And let's face it, what we believe has implications. It doesn't matter if we are an atheist, that has implications. If we're an agnostic, it has implications for the way that we live. If we are believers in Christ, it's supposed to make a difference in the way that we live. And all futurist eschatologies have implications for the way people live. And it's certainly true that all three of the eschatological views teach moral living. They teach ethical conduct. But, you know, William, you and I have discussed it before. One noted dispensationalist, when asked whether or not Christians ought to be involved in public life, whether or not Christians ought to be involved in society, whether they ought to even vote and things like that, because after all, the Bible says evil men and seducers shall grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. That's supposed to describe the time that we're living in. That's supposed to describe the last days. Therefore, if the world's just doomed to get worse and worse, what's the point? And this particular dispensationalist, in response to a question, said, you don't polish brass on a sinking ship. His meaning obviously being, there's no sense, purpose, or success to Christians being involved really in the political and social world, because after all, God has predestinated it, i.e. Predicted it to be worse and getting worse all the time. So, yeah, what we believe definitely has implications for the way that we live. And I believe that's absolutely true in regard to covenant eschatology. What we believe certainly has implications for the way that we're going to live. And there's another aspect of this. You and I have been confronted how many times, William, by opponents of covenant eschatology who say, well, in the New Testament, eschatology was the ground for ethical paranesis, for ethical and moral exhortation. Therefore, if the Lord's come, we don't have any ground for ethics or morality. So this question, how should we then live, is extremely, extremely important. And it's a really good case that when people say, well, you know, eschatology is just kind of an academic exercise, it doesn't really matter, it's going to all pan out in the wash, that's absolutely not true. Because what we believe has implications for the way that we live.
That's right. You know, it's been said that a person will not act beyond their belief in most cases. If we don't believe something is possible or true, we tend not to act. And I know that's not an absolute because, you know, there's certainly, you know, times when people do. But, you know, for the most part, we never rise above the level of our belief.
Well, that's exactly right. And let's take an example, a really modern example. The other day I was seeing a study that had been done about benevolent giving. In response to the Katrina disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular study was revealing that Christian organizations, use that term Christian as broadly as you want. I mean, lots and lots of organizations even that we would have severe theological issues with. Set all that aside. But Christian organizations gave incredibly generously for relief efforts at Katrina. Atheist organizations barely even registered on the map. Well, I wonder why that is. The reason for that being, an atheist doesn't have any ground, doesn't have any logical basis, doesn't have any ideological justification for being magnanimous toward his fellow neighbors, toward his fellow human beings. After all, only the strong survive, survival of the fittest. It's all about me. It's not about anything or anyone else. I am the center of my universe. Why should I care about what happens to others? Now, are there exceptions? Are there atheists who are magnanimous and generous? Yes, kind of like you were pointing out. Some people rise above their belief system. That's the exception, not the rule. And this particular research verified that by pointing out that the huge amount of benevolent, generous relief giving separate from the government was done by Christian organizations. And the atheists just hardly gave anything.
Yeah, that's an important point, Don, and it's a very positive point to consider, especially when most of the eschatologies out there are focused on the fact that, you know, the world continues to get worse. Evil men and seducers get worse and worse, and they're using these as signs of the end, et cetera. But when you see the fact that Christianity around the world, and as you were describing it in terms of, you know, as loosely as a person may use that term, you see this kind of fruit of the Spirit, if you please, from
yes.
that perspective. When you see that, those are the positive things that don't get, you know, necessarily reported in the news, that they're not the accidents and, you know, people getting swallowed by tigers and all this kind of stuff, you know, whatever the negative things are on the news. But this is the kind of information that people needs to be brought to the attention of people, and especially those who are looking for the positive things in the world or doubting whether or not there is. And, you know, I would just love to see some statistics on how the world has changed. It's been documented before, even in the millennial studies. Lorraine Bettner, in his book, and, you know, he even documented how the progress of the world has continued since the days of the apostles, et cetera. And yet so many people, particularly millennialists, seems to buy into and when I say I meant the, you know, dispensationalists seem to buy into the negativity of the world, and not only them, but, you know, many others as well.
Well, you and I were both raised in the amillennial world, and I know that I heard lesson after lesson after lesson as a young man preaching on 2 Peter chapter 3, saying evil men and seducers will wax worse and worse. You know, I certainly was not raised in a dispensational environment. I was raised in a very strong amillennial environment. And a lot of the ministers that I heard as young men growing up would cite that passage.
Mm-hmm.
And I well remember in California as a young man being impressed by lessons coming from the pulpit teaching Christians that it's futile. And useless to be involved in politics because the world is going to get worse. There's nothing we can do. Only the coming of Christ can solve the solutions. Christ is going to come, destroy the earth, make everything right with Christians. And, of course, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 was one of the most off-cited passages, you know, about Christ is going to give us relief from the troubles of this world. And the troubles of this world were interpreted to mean, well, it may be cancer, it may be heart trouble, it may be financial difficulty, it may be this or it may be that, which is totally ignoring the context of 2 Thessalonians 1. But be that as it may, I remember those type of sermons that overtly encouraged Christians not to be involved in the world, that just openly stated this world has to get worse, will get worse. There's nothing we can do about it. Well, in one way, pardon me, we can look at what's happening in American society today, and we can see pretty effectively, pretty powerfully, how The evangelical community has been silent for so long. They haven't voted based upon morality. They haven't voted based upon ethics. They haven't voted upon integrity. They voted on their pocketbooks. And we're in a mess today in America. We keep getting ourselves in worse and worse condition by politicians who have no moral certitude about them. I mean, it's just one parade after another of politicians who are corrupt, who are immoral, et cetera, et cetera. And again, it is, in my estimation, my personal opinion, a whole lot of it is based upon the fact that Americans have been voting according to the pocketbook. What can the government give me, put in my pocket, pay my bills? It's not about what is right. Where are we headed as a nation? What is good for this nation instead of what can I get about? I go back to John F. Kennedy's very, very famous statement. Do not ask what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for the country.
Yes.
And we've lost that sense. We've lost that question.
Well, it's definitely true that we need, you know, more responsibility and accountability in, you know, areas of government and from the citizens, you know, nationwide, to reflect on the values that will move the country forward. You know, it doesn't help anybody, whether they are, you know, your top business people or your, you know, the lower levels of poverty, to be in a handout situation. And I know that, you know, it's defined different ways, but it boils down to the same thing. I mean, they talk about, you know, pork barrel, what's the term?
Yeah, pork barrel spending, yeah.
Yeah, in the government. So you have some of the same things on all levels. But here's one of the things that has really helped to put things in check as we move forward. And this is another one of the advancements. I mean, you know, take our area of science and technology. Now, I don't think there's a single person who could look at what's happening today in the area of technology and engineering sciences, et cetera, and say that we are going backwards. I mean, all you got to do is pick up your smartphone, right?
Amen. That's what I'm talking on.
So when you look at that, you can see tremendous progress. But also, with these types of technology, have come more systems for accountability. We are able to get information out faster than we have in the past. We are able to have checks and balances through these systems that we didn't have before, whereas everything was like paper systems, and it took forever, you know, to document things and to find out what's going on. I mean, now it's like immediate. I mean, you could be flashed across the world in a matter of seconds, and which means that, you know, there are systems in place for greater accountability. And so when the news gets out there, if it's reported accurately, people have an opportunity to respond much faster, and so things can happen at a faster pace. But these are some of the advancements that people seem to overlook. And, it's, you know, we know that both in the area of ethics, in the area of morality, all of those things are you know, essential and critical in order for us to look at. But when they are lacking, we have these other systems in place. I mean, you know, think about DNA, how before you could falsely accuse a person of murdering someone or killing them and just go on someone's testimony, and that testimony could be prejudiced, it could be insufficient, et cetera. But now you can do, you know, tests where they can determine whether or not this person has raped another person or has, you know, been involved with the crime in some way just by using, you know, DNA. I'm not saying it's totally, you know, accurate. You know, I'm not sure of all the testing that they do. But the point is, we have made tremendous progress. And I would say that some of these, you know, inventions, some of these scientific discoveries, et cetera, are motivated by people who have Christian principles in mind. They are trying to do something good in the world for the most part, rather than something evil in the world. And oftentimes we discredit or maybe do not, I won't say we discredit them, but we do not acknowledge the fact that these things are contributing to the advancement of the world from and the advancement of Christian principles in the world. You know, take, again, this technology, look at the children around the world who are being abused, sold into slavery, and things, you know, of that nature. When you have people who can report it with their cell phone, you know, snap a picture and send, you know, there's just a lot of things that can be done and that should be done and are being done, I think, along those lines. So, you know, I continue to try to look for, you know, I hear it all the time. Everybody is always talking about the devil made me do it and the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But I'm always on the lookout for as much positive as I can find. And I know, and here's, let me just close this comment with this. I remember a survey that I took, you know, it was like a psychological survey or where they do it, you know, for hiring of employees. And when you take that survey, what it determines and what they've determined is that 80% of the people in the world are generally good people. You know, it's like the 80-20 rule. Now, I know other people have the opinion that there's only 20% there. But that's the way, that's generally the way they sit. And one thing that I, you know, that they've said about those surveys is that you pretty much pass them based on your outlook and perspective. And so, you know, you could have a lot of people just not telling the truth, but I tend to think that people are answering them, you know, pretty much the way they see the world. And what they've shown is that 80% of it is generally positive. Now, that could have changed. It's been some time ago when that information was available, but, you know, that's kind of the way I see it. And I'm always looking for, you know, some positive things in the world, and we just don't look enough, I think.
Well, I think you're exactly right. You know, and you've touched on an awful lot of things there that are really exciting things to me. I've been, with the advent of, for instance, of the DNA, I've been an advocate for a good long time of more extensive use in order to prevent the wrongful incarceration of people. It's like you say, it's such an absolutely horrible injustice that in times past, people have been incarcerated, they've been imprisoned, some have been put to death based on the flimsiest of evidence. And now with this marvelous advent of DNA, and of course it is so tremendously accurate. Is it possible to contaminate it? Yeah, we hear about that all the time. But overall, it's such an incredibly wonderful tool, and we see and we hear of stories all of the time of someone that's been exonerated who had been wrongly imprisoned in the past, wrongly accused, but they managed to get the testing done because someone, you know, they saved some samples, they managed to get the DNA, and lo and behold, they've been declared innocent. What an incredibly wonderful, positive development for the world that we live in. And that's just one tiny little aspect of our world. And you know, I'll share something with you, William.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to be a fairly positive person, I think. In fact, people comment on it every once in a while. You've always got a smile on your face and what have you. Well, I went into a business the other day, and little gal, very pretty young woman, sitting behind the counter, and I, you know, was, hi, how you doing, da-da-da-da, and she was just like, oh, I'm okay, I guess. I said, why, what's wrong? Well, I don't know. And she was really negative, and she goes, why are you so chipper? I said, why wouldn't I be? I said, I'm a child of God. I said, my health is good. I got a wonderful family. I love my job, and it's a wonderful world to live in. And she looked up at me like I was from Mars. And, I mean, she literally
was. Well,
you
were. You're not of this world.
And she was literally just so stunned. Well, she started telling me a little bit about her trouble, and nothing that she told me was major, but she was in an incredibly negative frame of mind over it. And I said, let me say something to you. I said, do you know what? If you just really honestly want to take a look around, it won't take you but just a minute or so to find someone that's in a whole lot worse condition than you are, who has a whole lot more trouble than you do. And she looked up at me and she goes, "You know what? You are absolutely right." And we just started talking. And she's going, "Well, what do you do?" You know, and I told her I'm an evangelist and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. By the time I left, she was in a very, very positive mood. And she thanked me, you know, for sharing these things with her. Well, I have a tendency to think that people are mostly good, kind of like you were saying there. We have a tendency, however, to do exactly what Paul said we shouldn't. And that is, Paul said, we do not look at the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. He even chided the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. He said, you put too much emphasis on the things that you see. Well, that's precisely what's wrong with so many people today.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't have faith so that they can see beyond the fact, okay, they don't have a lot of money. Well, certainly that's not the happiest thing in the world, but it's not the end of the world. They don't have the ability to see beyond the physical things that are happening in their life and to be able to look at the things that transcend the things of this world, because many of them don't have faith. They don't have a sure foundation and a confidence in things that are eternal. And, you know, if I didn't have my faith in the Lord, my confidence in his word, my trust in the fact that he's kept his word, I think I'd be a pretty negative person. Because there is a lot in this world that if you focus on just this world, just what you see, it can be pretty bad. I was listening to a radio program today, and I was talking about all of the things going on in our government today. And, you know, you sit and you listen to it, and you go, "Oh, good grief, horrible." Well, I don't like a lot of it, but it's not the end of my world. And so I try personally, and I try to share with people, that there is something bigger and better and greater than the troubles of this world.
Yeah, you know, that reminded me of the story, and you know, I never try to tell these stories because I never get them right, but hopefully this one will make a little sense to some. But there was this guy who was traveling along the way, and he was headed to this city. And so he stopped along the way to ask some people, you know, how were the people in the city? You know, what was it like? And one person that he asked told him that, you know, well, it's the people there are just a bunch of derelicts. You know, it's a terrible place to be. They're, you know, full of criminals and all kinds of stuff. And so that's what he saw when he got there. He stopped and he met another guy, and another person asked, he says, "Well, what is the city like?" And they said, "Well, oh, it's a beautiful place. The people are nice. The people are friendly. Everyone shares and they get along well. There's prosperity going on and plenty of food to eat and everything." And he went there, and that's what he found. So a lot of times it has a lot to do. And so what you're saying about a person's mindset, about their belief system, and especially about the eternal blessings that God has given to us and the assurances that he's given to us in his word, allow us to live with a different mindset, allow us to live above the world. You know, you were talking a moment ago about this lady who, you know, was kind of down in the dumps, and she kind of saw, you know, her world very bleak. It reminded me some years ago when Max King came down and visited our church some years ago, and he preached a sermon from Philippians chapter 1. And he kind of started it off the way you did. And, you know, he said, you know, they asked this person, "How are they doing?" He says, "Well, I'm doing pretty good under the circumstances." And he says, "Well, what are you doing under there in the first place?" So that's kind of the way it is. You know, when you're in Christ, I mean, look at all of those positive passages we have. You know, scriptures like Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You know, that's empowering. That builds a person's courage and strength. It empowers them. You have a text like Ephesians 3:20, unto me. How's that text start? That says, now unto him who is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. And I realize it's the first century context of that, but the principles of that are just so transforming. They're just so powerful to think about texts like that. And those kind of passages sustain a person in time of need. And one of my favorite is, you know, Philippians 4, where, you know, he says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. So, you know, if a Christian truly believed that, if anybody believed that and understood the promise God is making them in these types of passages, you know, they would just be empowered every morning when they get up to have a worldview and a mindset that is you know, confident and one of a conqueror and not of a victim and not of a, you know, woe is me type of mindset.
You know, you referred to Philippians there a couple of different times. Years ago, William, I produced a 38 lesson series entitled No Matter What Happens. And it was based upon, taken from, it was 38 lessons from the book of Philippians. And as you well know, Paul uses the word, the Greek word joy, some 16 times in this little book that we have divided up into four chapters. And when people understand the historical context of the writing of that letter, then it's absolutely astounding that Paul could use the word joy at all.
Absolutely.
Paul was in prison, unjustly accused, suffering at the hands of the Romans because of the jealousy of the Jews, because of the hatred and animosity of the Jews, who falsely accused him to the Roman authorities, had him thrown in jail, scourged, and thrown in prison. Now, you can read some of this in Acts chapter 16, and the story of Paul at Philippi and how he was wrongly imprisoned. Now, I've often thought and I've often wondered, okay, if I were in Paul's place, if I'm downtown one day and the police just arbitrarily pull me over, jerk me out of my car, beat me to a pulp, and take me downtown and throw me in the jail, and all the time I'm going, what did I do? What did I do? And it's never mind. You know, we're throwing you in prison. You ain't nothing but a troublemaker. We don't like what you're doing. We don't like what you're saying. Then would I be as magnanimous? Would I be as positive, you know, as the apostle? And as I said, I produced this 38 lesson series entitled No Matter What Happens, because you see that attitude. Paul says, no matter what happens, whether I'm imprisoned, whether I die, or whether I don't, I'm going to glorify the Lord. No matter what condition I find myself, I'm going to glorify the Lord. And all throughout the book, principle after principle after principle after principle, we see that commitment of Paul that said, no matter what happens to me under these circumstances, you know, he was saying, the Praetorian Guard, as a result of my imprisonment, the Praetorian Guard is going to hear the gospel. Now, wait a minute. The Praetorian Guard was the inner circle, the hardest of the hard, the most well-trained of the well-trained soldiers in the entire Roman army. You wouldn't expect the Praetorian Guard to listen to anything from anyone, that is, of a prisoner. And yet Paul says, my imprisonment has fallen out so that the Praetorian Guard, even the Praetorian Guard, is going to hear the gospel of Christ. So Paul says, no matter what happens to me, I'm going to preach the gospel, even if it's these hard case Praetorian Guard soldiers. That's amazing.
Yeah, it really
and,
is.
By the way, for those who are listening and those who are listening on the archive, yes, I do offer this series on Philippians, these 38 lessons, entitled No Matter What Happens. And I consider it some of the most uplifting, some of the most important what now type of lessons that a person could consider. Because Paul understood that not only his life, but the end of the age was at hand. Philippians chapter 4, the Lord is at hand. So he understood that the day of the Lord was at hand. He also understood, contrary to the three major eschatologies that are in the world today, that the day of the Lord was not the end of the world. It was, to be sure, a revolutionary time that was going to change radically the social order of the world. But life was going to go on, and he expected and he taught Christians how to live in light of this coming new world order. And so he could write to the Romans even. And he could say, let us walk honestly as in the day. My YouTube presentation just this morning was on Romans chapter 13, verse 11 to 13, where Paul says, let us put off the works of darkness, let there be no rioting, wantonness, drunkenness, extortion. You know, he goes over issues of personal integrity, personal morality, social conduct, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, you put those things away from you, and you put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and do not make provision for the flesh, but you walk honestly as in the day. That is, you act as if the day of the Lord's already come, and you're living beyond it. You're walking in the daylight of Christ. So here again, how should we then live? Well, Paul says, here's how you're supposed to live in the day and after the day arrives. You don't live this kind of a life. So
yeah.
We're dealing with extremely practical, extremely important ethical conduct in light of eschatology, to be sure, but not just simply in light of eschatology, but saying when it is fulfilled, here's how you live.
Yeah, when you think about, you know, even women, for example, and how women issues have changed and how they are treated, you know, both socially as well as, you know, in areas of business. I know that there are still some inequities that exist with women and their pay for jobs that they do that are comparable to the jobs that men do. And that's not to be overlooked. But at the same time, there have been just tremendous strides in the way, you know, women are treated. And I believe that's because of you know, Christian principles that permeate society. And, you know, as people learn better, you know, they do better and treat them much better. And so there's a great degree of respect that women get today that they did not get. And we know and are very sensitive to the abuses that still exist. You know, they're still exploited in lots of ways, and both, you know, adults and young women. But at the same time, you know, we have to say a lot has taken place, both, you know, politically, business-wise, socially, in terms of the heights that they're reaching and the things that they're doing. And so that's just another area where things have improved. And especially if you compare them with, you know, I know there, you know, there were different cultures, but if you compare them with things in the past, I think anyone should be able to see that there's a lot that has changed.
Well, and to raise an issue, obviously, it's been an unbelievably sad story in American history, and that's the issue of racial inequity. You know, the issue of slavery. As I look back and I examine how the church, the Christian church, was amazingly silent in the lead up to the Civil War, and it's such a sad testimony to how Christianity could have had much more of a profound and much more of a positive impact on American society in regard to this issue of slavery and, you know, racism. And yet, what happened? Well, by and large, when the church did speak up, it spoke up according to North versus South, pro-slavery versus anti-slavery. It wasn't really based upon any solid exegetical basis in their attempts to justify slavery. You know, what little I've read, been able to find on those anti-slavery, you know, commentary, they actually made some pretty good arguments. They actually did. But if we try to look at the issue objectively, certainly there's still an awful lot of racial inequity in America. I think you shared with me that the unemployment rate among young African-American blacks is incredibly high. It's way too high, and it should not be that way. And so there's certainly still an awful lot of inequity that abounds. And yet, with that said, thanks to the work of Martin Luther King, and people can talk about, well, his weaknesses of the flesh all they want to, but you have to appreciate the work that he did. It's kind of like Martin Luther. You know, people could talk about Martin Luther was a crass, vulgar, you know, pretty ribald fellow. Well, he was. But he also accomplished an awful lot because he was dedicated to the cause. And that's true of an awful lot of men and women in history who have been dedicated to a cause. You may be able to find fault with their personal lives, but you have to appreciate the courage and the dedication they had to their personal cause. And as a result of that, things in America from a racial perspective have improved dramatically. We've still got a way to go, but what does the Bible have to say about this from a genuine perspective? How should we then live? I taught a class on the book of Philemon. I don't think I've got it available. I consider the book of Philemon to be one of the most radical, revolutionary, world-changing epistles in the entire Bible when you consider the social and cultural environment in which it was written. And William, you know this very well, that in both the Roman and in the Jewish world, if a slave ran away, that could be a death penalty.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly in the Roman world, and there were laws that were passed that if a slave ran away and someone found them, they had a legal obligation to return that slave to their owner or they themselves could be punished. And in the Jewish world, there were provisions under Torah for a more equitable treatment of slaves than there was even under the Roman law. Roman law gave slaves absolutely no rights whatsoever. There was a book that was written some years ago, Everyday Lives, that does a fantastic job of describing what it was like under Roman law. And to just give a really super-duper brief overview here, in Roman society, and this is the way it became in American society, unfortunately, but in Roman society, a slave was considered literally just a piece of property, as a chair might be a piece of property. If a slave owner decided that he did not like a slave for any given reason, he had no legal responsibility to explain himself whatsoever. In the city of Rome, a slave owner could hire what we today would call a hitman, but they had squads. They had men that could be hired. They were just, I guess to use a modern analogy, all you'd have to do is look in the Yellow Pages and there you'd find slave killer. And you could hire this assassin to come and kill your slave. And the going rate was X amount of money. And you had to buy the pitch to burn the body with. That's the only obligation you had. And the slave had no recourse. He had no court of appeal. There was nothing he could do about it. If the slave owner said, go get my slave Zacharias or whatever, do away with him, I'm tired of him, he's not productive or whatever, you know, if he just didn't like him anymore, Then here comes the hit squad. He kills the man, burns the body. There was not one word in the Roman legal system that could prevent that or that even did anything about it. There were laws on the books. For instance, there's one very, very famous story in Roman society of how a slave killed his master. The Roman authorities came in, and this was an extremely, extremely large household. The Roman authorities came in, lined up these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of slaves, and killed every 10th slave in order to send a message, you know, that this would not be tolerated. Now, I could go on and on and on relating all of this, but the point being that slaves had absolutely no legal rights whatsoever. Normally, if a slave ran away, the punishment was death. Okay, here's the book of Philemon. Paul's in prison in Rome. Now, Paul had converted Onesimus, had converted Philemon, who was the owner of Onesimus. Onesimus was the slave. We don't know why. We're not given any clues. Onesimus ran away. Now, again, Paul had converted Philemon. And Onesimus knew that Paul and Philemon had a great relationship. Why Onesimus ran away to Paul, we don't really know specifically. But Onesimus had also been converted. But Onesimus runs away to Paul in Rome. So here's Paul in prison. Now, Paul was given a certain degree of freedom while he was in prison, but be that as it may. Now, Paul is being put in an incredibly, incredibly difficult position. Paul's literally between a rock and a hard place. Onesimus is a Christian. Philemon is a Christian. But according to Roman law, and here's Paul in a Roman prison, according to Roman law, Paul is obligated to send Onesimus back. So what does he do? Does he send Onesimus back to his death? Well, he writes this little bitty, tiny, short epistle. And as I've already stated, I think it's one of the most revolutionary epistles in the entire Bible. Written in that culture at that time, when Onesimus should have been killed for running away if he was returned by Paul, Paul writes a letter back to Philemon and evidently sends it by Onesimus. He tells Onesimus, hey, go back home. And don't you know Onesimus is going, really, Paul? You really want me to go back? And Paul says, yeah, take this letter with you. But what Paul says in this little bitty epistle, he tells him, I could command you, Philemon, but I'm not going to do that. I'm appealing to you in love. And he says, I want you to treat Onesimus not as a slave, but as a brother. Nothing like that had ever been written before. Nothing like that had ever even been suggested before. What an absolutely incredible message. I mean, here's a guy that you bought and paid for under Roman law. He has been up to this point nothing but a piece of property to you that you can dispose of, and now you're supposed to consider him your equal and your brother. Wow. The question of how should we then live? You see, what Paul was introducing was new covenant realities. Boy, was he ever creating a new creation, William.
Oh, that, most certainly.
That the church still needs to grasp the full import of today. But I'm just astounded at the power of the Book of Philemon. I really am.
Yeah, it's a great book. I remember, you know, covering that book, and you know, when you see that, it makes it so powerful when he tells him, you know, to treat him as a brother. And just that principle alone, if people, you know, understood the brotherhood of all men from that perspective, you know, it would revolutionize the way the world is today. You know, it would change the world just based on that. You know, some of the earliest principles and violations of that principle started, you know, started in Genesis when Abel killed his brother, and then you can see Abraham appealing to Lot by saying, "We be brethren." So that's a very powerful principle of, you know, understanding the relationships that should exist between, you know, men in this world. And that's what Christianity does, is declares, you know, the brotherhood of all men, both in and out of Christ. And, you know, just that alone should be, you know, a transforming message.
Well, I have been preaching for years and years that the church has an awful long way to go in fully implementing what we know on one level, know on an intellectual level to be true, and that's just like this. I'm reminded of something Martin Luther said. The Reformation movement had begun to gain some leverage, had begun to gain some speed. Martin Luther, every Sunday, every Mass, and of course the strange thing was that even though Martin Luther was railing against the Pope, railing and condemning what was going on in Rome and the Catholic Church as a whole, even though he was calling for absolute radical change and condemning what he saw as abuses, et cetera, well, he continued to hold Mass. He continued to do some of the very things that he was condemning. And he was accosted by one of his followers on one occasion after a lesson in which he had just blasted the Mass as reprehensible, as ungodly, et cetera, and how the Pope was, we can't use Martin Luther's language on this program. That's why I said Martin Luther was a rather ribald, he could be very vulgar in his preaching. But be that as it may, he had delivered this scathing lesson about the abuses in the Mass and the abuses of the Catholic Church, et cetera, and yet here he was holding Mass. And one of his followers asked him, he said, "Wait a minute, you know, how can you do this? Sunday after Sunday, you condemn the Mass, you condemn the Pope, you condemn the papacy, all these type things, and yet here you are conducting Mass." And Martin Luther, it was reported, said, "It is a great distance from knowing the truth and practicing the truth, applying it." You know, tradition is extremely strong. We all know that. It's difficult to change. So here was one of the greatest men, in my estimation, that in the history of the Christian Church. I just have the most deep-seated appreciation for Martin Luther. Obviously, I don't agree with all of his doctrines, but I just appreciate the man for what he did and for what he accomplished and what he stood for in so many ways. But he understood that traditions die hard. He understood that he was even being inconsistent, and he wasn't even himself properly applying the things that he was preaching every Sunday. Well, how often in the modern church do we actually preach equity, equality, love for one another, et cetera, and yet we don't apply those things ourselves? We are human beings. We still have our weaknesses and our foibles. But the power of the message is there. And we need, as believers in Jesus Christ, to begin to apply those. What's the name of the minister? Is it Warren? Oh my goodness!
Are you talking about the purpose-driven guy?
No, the emergent church fellow. My goodness. No, Rick Warren is the not the emergent church, but the purpose-driven church.
Yeah. Yeah.
The emergent church leader. I can see his face and what have you. But he wrote a book, something like The Radical Christian, or Radical Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read part of the book. I haven't read all of it, but I was told about it, and I was told, boy, Don, you really ought to get this. You ought to read what he's got to say. And what's disturbing is I've actually met him and talked with him face-to-face, and I still can't think of his name. I know I'll think of it the moment we hang up. But as I read the book, how radical Christianity really is if genuinely applied. And as I read the book, I thought, I've been preaching this stuff all of my life. Why is he calling it so radical? Well, the reason he's calling it so radical is because Christians as a whole have failed to apply it. And he was saying, look what a radically different society we could create. We actually started preaching or acting out what we're preaching and what the text says. How should we live? Well, we need to start applying what we've been saying. And, William, I'm going to leave it there because we're being told we've got about 30 seconds left. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening, so I'm going to say good night and God bless.
All right. Well, Don, thank you for the message today. And you know, it's certainly a good series, and I think we, you know, should continue on this train of thought for the coming weeks. And by the way, before we go, we have just a couple of minutes here. I did get a chance to talk with our great and longtime friend, Jack Scott.
All right.
Yeah, and he said he'd be very open to having a conversation if we can, you know, find the time to work it into a schedule. And so I know that that may be a little bit of a challenge for a time, but I look forward to the time where all three of us could be on here and just have a good time. So, Jack, if you're listening or if you get a chance to hear us, you know, we certainly are looking forward to it. And it was really great to talk to him and just to, you know, to hear from him again. So
I really, really miss interacting with Jack.
Yeah.
Great fellow.
Yeah, so we will do that in time to come. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, thank you for tuning in to Two Guys and a Bible. And with that, I'm going to say good night as well and have a very good evening.
Thank you for joining the Two Guys and a Bible radio broadcast. On behalf of Dunn Preston and myself, we'd like to say have a very pleasant day and may God bless. Until next time, we'll see you on Fulfill Radio, a voice you can trust.